it's the Tully Ringy Legal Power Hour on 810 WGY.
Good evening. You're listening to the Tully Ringy Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Ringy, and each Sunday at 7 p.m., I'm joined by attorneys from my law firm, Tully Ringy PLLC, to give you our insight on the legal and political issues happening locally and across the country that affect you. In addition to listening on your radio, we're broadcasting around the world on WGY.com. Visit our show site at TullyRinkyShow.com for podcasts of previous shows. Tonight, I'm joined by Tully Ringy criminal defense attorney, Tom Carr. Welcome, Tom.
Yeah, glad to be here, Greg.
And Karen Nosel joins us in studio tonight. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you, Greg.
We're going to take a look at some interesting topics and some of last month's most popular news stories affecting the legal and political landscape, including the ghost ticket scandal in Albany, possible increase on sex offender laws in Colony, could sex offenders be moving next door to you, the disturbing case of domestic violence in a young celebrity relationship, which has been the rage, and I'm sure Karen's going to have some insight into that, and the legal troubles plaguing former Senator Joe Bruno. We also have a new on guest with us tonight, Karen Nosel, that tonight is her first night on the show with us, and we're looking forward to having her. If you have any questions for us throughout the show, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY or press *WGY on your cell phone. Well, Tom, let's talk a little bit about this ghost ticket investigation and scandal that's going on or was going on in Albany. And was it only Albany?
Yeah, Greg, it was situation peculiar to Albany, whereby certain people, apparently normally family members of police officers, were given a little bullseye sticker to put in the windshield of their car. And if they parked at a meter and the meter expired, they would get a ticket, but it would be a no-fine ticket.
Now, where were these bullseyes coming from? Who was handing out these bullseyes?
Well, that's something that's not readily apparent at this point. It seems like the union may have had something to do with it.
So now, was this only if you were parked at a meter? I mean, if you were parked illegally in a handicap zone or if you were parked in a fire zone, would this bullseye get you out of a ticket there also?
Apparently, the bullseye, once it was displayed in the windshield, would get you one of these no-fine tickets. So to the casual observer, they'd see a parking enforcement officer writing out a ticket and putting it on the windshield. But the ticket had no legal effect because it was a no-fine ticket, meaning you didn't have to pay a fine for parking there. And they seem to work anywhere that the car was parked.
I got to tell you, when you're parked in downtown Albany, the meters down there are extremely annoying. I think it's, what, 25 cents for 6 minutes or something?
Yeah, and as someone who frequently goes down to court in Albany, first of all, the meters have a two-hour limit, so good luck if you're going to get in and out within the 2 hours. Second of all, it's I think it's six quarters for an hour, so it's
so you got to carry around a roll of quarters with you every time you go downtown as an attorney or someone who's conducting business down there.
Exactly. I frequently have a roll of quarters in my pocket for that purpose.
Now, Karen, what's your thoughts on this? How do you feel about some people getting out of parking tickets just by who they know?
Well, for the most part, I think it's kind of unfair. You know, I mean, here's all the rest of us parking downtown, and what if we run into the situation? You know, we can't get out of it. We're going to end up paying tickets. You know, I know people too, but...
Now, Tom, when you've been downtown, I'm sure your meter has run out, right?
Yes, indeed. It's a $40 ticket. I can attest to that.
So you've gotten a ticket?
Yes, I have.
But now, if you had had this bullseye sticker on your car, and where would this sticker go?
I believe it went on the windshield, round about where the registration and inspection sticker is.
Have you ever seen any of these?
I never noticed them, to be honest, but, you know, a lot of people have stickers in their car. You just don't pay attention to them.
Right. I've never seen them either. Now, I believe that the Times Union has reported that the mayor has basically said that he knows nothing about this. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Apparently, the mayor knew nothing about it, and the police chief, when it was announced, came out and said, hey, I didn't know this was going on.
Which I would find very hard to believe is that the police chief didn't know what was going on.
Well, the question is, who was handing out the stickers? Was it the union or was it the police department? It seems to have been something that was precipitated way back when by the union.
But now, even if it was the union handing out the tickets, who gives tickets in Albany? I mean, who's the people that go around and give tickets? We have
They're parking enforcement officers, and they work for the city of Albany, just like Albany Police Department.
So somebody had to be tipping them off and saying, hey, if you see this sticker, because it wasn't like they were giving them regular tickets, right? And then the tickets would be squashed later on by the DA or by the police.
Correct. They were, at the outset, they were written as no fine tickets.
So this tells me that there had to be more people that were involved in this and more people that knew about it at higher levels because, I mean, if you're telling the ticket people, hey, give this special type of no-fine ticket to people with these bullseyes, that kind of tells me that there was more people implicit in this.
Well, it seems to have been something that was going on the download to a certain extent. I don't think there was any memos coming out of City Hall saying don't do this, but I think that those people who were in a position to give out tickets knew or were made aware by other people that, hey, if you see this bullseye, this is the kind of a ticket that you write.
Now, how long was this going on for before this was and let's talk a little bit about first how long it was going on for, and then how did this come to light?
Well, apparently it's been going on for more than 15 years.
Wow.
So that's a lot of tickets.
That is. That's a lot of ticket and a lot of money, I mean, that Albany potentially, you know, could be using, especially in these, you know, recession times.
Absolutely. And the Times Union did its own investigation, and it said that since 2003, roughly 5,000 no-fine tickets were issued. So that's only in the last 5 years. It's been going on for three times that long, at least, apparently.
Now, would it be legal? And I guess this is a question that, you know, I'm throwing out there, and myself as a lawyer, I don't know the answer to this off the top of my head, but when they go back and they see who got these no-fine tickets, could they issue fine tickets at this point?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't think that has been looked into. That certainly hasn't been done at this point.
What do you think, Karen, from a layperson's perspective? I mean, do you think that we should go back and look at the list of who got these no-fine tickets and make them pay the fine like anyone else?
Absolutely, Greg. And, you know, I actually have a question about, you know, 15 years of, you know, these no-fine tickets. Don't the police officers in Albany have a quota to meet? You know, don't they have to reach a quota of how many tickets they give and how much money they bring in?
That's a very touchy subject.
And, you know, I mean, in the end, you know, I'm getting twice as many tickets as I normally would because they're not making up for it for these other people getting away for it.
That's a good point. Tom, is there really a quota? I know I've always heard that rumor that there's a quota, and towards the end of the month, you know, if you're speeding, you're probably going to get that ticket.
Well, the official answer to that is no, there is not a quota. It would not be appropriate for any police department to have a quota. However, anecdotally, tickets seem to be issued more frequently towards the end of the month as though somebody were trying to make up a quota, but of course nobody really has a quota officially.
Now, the other question that I have is this is very similar, I guess, to what's you know known as PBA cards or stickers that are handed out when you make a donation to your local police department. And people think that if you make a donation to the local PBA and you get the sticker, maybe you're going to get out of a ticket. First off, Tom, does that really work? And what's the difference between this and, you know, a sticker that you get when you give, you know, $100 to the local PBA?
Well, I think that the difference is if you get one of those PBA cards, it's discretionary on the part of the police officer that pulls you over as to whether or not he's going to cut you a break. But it seems to have been a policy, albeit an unwritten policy, with these bullseye tickets or bullseye stickers, that once you saw one of these bullseye stickers in the windshield of the car, automatically a no-fine ticket was generated. So there was no discretion. It was a pretty much, as I said, a policy. Whereas with the PBA sticker or the PBA card, you know, it might cut you a break. It might not.
But now this is something that's been going on for many years, probably from the start of a lot of police departments, is the handing out of these PBA cards to identify to other police officers' family members. And should a policeman, and policemen are out there, I know that they're working hard every day putting their life on the line, God bless them, but should we be extending this to their families, these PBA cards? And I guess one of the questions is it's kind of gotten out of control, is because the PBA cards usually don't just end up in families' hands but end up in friends' hands. And really, where do you draw the line, and why should some people be getting special treatment?
Yeah, basically, the cards are given out to anyone that has some form of a connection to a police officer. One of the things that has been proposed and that some places use is actually an official placard. It's like an 8.5 by 11 laminated thing which says, you know, certain police department, whatever it is, unofficial duty. And they're handed out for specific purposes of, you know, cops going down to court to testify when they're off duty and that kind of a thing. And I think that that's something that Albany is looking into, and it may alleviate some of the concerns about this. Because let's face it, if a cop, you know, has to go down as part of his job to testify, they're not going to give him a marked police car because they're taking it off the road. So he's going to have to go down there in his own personal vehicle. So why should a guy like that, who winds up sitting in court for 4, 5, 6 hours, have to pay a parking ticket?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think anyone is – and Karen, you can jump in any time, but I don't think anyone's going to fault a cop who's down there, you know, to testify or on official business. And no, they shouldn't have to pay the meter. I agree with that 100%. But what about if his daughter or his wife is downtown, you know, on doing her own type of business, whether it be going to school or shopping, and she can just park and not pay the meter? To me, that doesn't seem fair. And I guess what you're saying, Tom, really makes sense, is a placard of some sort that's issued by the police department and to be used only for official business makes sense to me.
Right. I think that, you know, when I was in the Brooklyn DA's office, we had them for that purpose. If we had to, for instance, respond to a crime scene or had to go out to the precinct for something, we'd have the placard. You could park at a meter, put the placard in the window. If the meter expired, well, you knew you weren't going to get hit with a ticket just because, you know, you're spending 3, 4, 5 hours down at the precinct.
But now if you took that home and you gave that to your wife to use, I would imagine that that would be a crime.
Oh, you'd certainly be in some trouble for that. There's a question as to whether or not you could be liable for impersonating a police officer if you had that. I mean, it says certain whatever the police department is on official business. So if you're a civilian, you're not affiliated with the police department, you're not on official business, then, yeah, you could be in trouble.
Now, at this point, who is investigating this?
Well, the Common Council of the city is up in arms about this, not least of which because they're concerned about all the lost revenue to the city over the last 15 years. So they're really pushing forward with this. Some of the council members are trying to get certain, like the union president in under subpoena to testify about this.
And do they have – does the Common Council of Albany have subpoena power? I mean, subpoena power is a very strong weapon that can be used. I mean, potentially they can force people to come in and testify. They could subpoena records and documents. But I know there's some debate as to whether the Albany Common Council has that power.
That's correct. And one of their attorneys has said that, you know, they can't bring the union president in under subpoena. The police chief, Chief Tuffy, has said that anyone that's directed to come in, anyone that's a member of the police department that's requested to go before the council, he will direct them to go in and answer their questions. But in terms of the subpoena power of the council, this issue is kind of opening up that can of worms. Do they have subpoena power? And if so, how far do they go?
So at this point, what is the status of these bullseyes? I mean, are the tickets being issued at this point? Has there been a directive?
Yeah, I think that once the scandal hit, the directive went out immediately from the police department that no one was to pay any attention to these bullseye stickers, and that if a car is parked illegally, then it should get a ticket.
We'd like to hear what you have to say tonight. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY or *WGY on your cell phones. If you have questions but can't join us tonight, don't forget that we can be reached all week at the Tully Rinke office at 518-218-7100. When we're back, we'll tell you about the new steps being taken in Colony to restrict the presence of sex offenders.
One of the worst experiences you can go through is to be charged with a DWI. But with the experienced attorneys from Tully Rinke on your side, you can be confident that your lawyer will fiercely fight to protect your rights and get you the best possible outcome. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke, PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.
You've worked hard to acquire your wealth. Let us help you keep it. Hi, I'm Abigail Doolittle, Portfolio Manager at Johnson Illington Advisors. Johnson Illington is a money management firm that provides very conservative and disciplined portfolio management services. Our main goal at Johnson Illington is to preserve and enhance your wealth. We have a highly experienced team led by nationally known investment veteran and economist Hugh Johnson. Visit our website at johnson-illington.com. Johnson Illington Advisors on Broadway in Albany.
All right, Integral One Network Solutions. Tell me what they do again.
Well, they worked with us to design our new computer network. That's really made a difference. Helps us run our business better. They monitor everything 24/7 to keep it running smoothly. And they manage it all, so I don't have to hire an IT guy.
So when I hire Integral One, they manage my network so I can manage my business. Talk about peace of mind.
Integral One Network Solutions. Online at integral1.net. That's integral1.net. 464-4014.
A traffic ticket is not a simple matter, and simply paying a traffic ticket might not be your best option. Just because you were issued a ticket doesn't mean you're guilty. The experienced attorneys at Tully Rinke have handled thousands of traffic and speeding tickets in New York. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke, PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York, and the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.
Welcome back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Rinke, and tonight I'm here with criminal defense attorney Tom Carr and the show's newest guest, Karen. We'll take a look at some of the past month's most talked about political and legal issues. If you hear something you want to give your opinion on, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. Feel free to check us out online anytime at TullyLegal.com. The next issue is definitely an issue that could be of interest to anyone out there who has small children or just doesn't feel comfortable living next to a convicted sex offender. And there have been restrictions on where sex offenders can live under Megan's Law, and most recently in Colony, there's been some proposed restrictions. And Tom, maybe you could bring us up to speed. What is Colony proposing?
What Colony is looking at is coming up with a law restricting where sex offenders can live in Colony. And this is given some impetus by a stretch of Central Avenue where there are a bunch of motels. And apparently the county has some contracts with these motels, and a lot of sex offenders are living in these motels. So rather than have them clustered together like that, Colony is looking into whether or not they can pass some restrictions to make sure that the sex offenders can't live, for instance, within 1,500 feet of each other.
Now, I got to stop you right there, Tom, because this really makes absolutely no sense to me, but so what's the problem? The problem is when they're clustered together, they're going to have more of an impetus to reoffend? I don't understand this.
That seems to be the theory behind this, that if a sex offender is off on his own somewhere, he may be less likely to reoffend. But if there's
a group... So we should spread them out all throughout Colony? I mean, this doesn't make sense to me. Karen, what do you think?
To tell you the truth, I'd like to hear more, but... clustering all together sounds scary. Spreading them out sounds scary.
It's a scary topic, but I just don't understand it. Right now, they're kind of housed together in hotels along Central Avenue. I don't understand what the big deal is. I mean, if we put them all together, will we I don't know. Tom, continue. What else do you have on this?
Yeah, it's been a question ever since Megan's Law went into effect and sex offenders were placed on the sex offender website. So you can log on and see where the sex offenders are living in terms of your zip code. You can get their actual addresses. And to a certain extent, it's really fueled some concern among the general public.
Well, I think rightfully so. I think people should be concerned if a sex offender moves next door to you and you have small kids. I think you should have the right to go onto a website and check it out and see, is there a sex offender living next to me? I think that makes sense. What do you think, Karen? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I'd like to know.
Well, I think that part of the issue deals with what is a sex offender. I think that some of it stems from the whole 80s concept of stranger danger, the dirty old man in the trench coat.
But that's not what it is anymore.
Exactly, and that's the problem. I mean, the demographic of sex offenders is something like 80 to 90% of sex offenders are already known to their victims before the victims are ever victimized.
So in some of these cases, you could have a sex offender. I know when I was in the Army as a JAG attorney, some of the cases that I prosecuted, I know would be, 19-year-old soldiers or something, having oral sex or something with a 16-year-old, and all of a sudden he's convicted, and now he's got a sex offense, and he has to register as a sex offender. Now, if this had been a college kid, You know, at home, I mean, really, would this have been a crime? Probably not. Probably would have been a probationary type of offense. But because he had been convicted under the UCMJ, we categorized it as a sex offense. He would then have to register as a sex offender, thus getting almost a triple whammy because he has a felony conviction, got a bad conduct discharge from the Army, and then has to register as a sex offender.
Well, that's actually happening in the civilian world, too. We have a lot of cases where, you know, kids who are underage and are having sex, technically they can be charged with a sex offense. In fact, there's a case out of Cape Cod right now where 13-year-olds are facing potential felony charges for sexting. And what sexting is...
Sexting?
Sexting. That's texting inappropriate pictures to somebody else. What happened in that case was apparently a 13-year-old girl took a semi-nude picture of herself on her cell phone, texted it to her boyfriend, a 13-year-old boy. He then texted it to five of his friends, and now they're all facing the charges of possession of child pornography for having this image on their cell phones. And if they were convicted of that, you know, they could be forced to register as sex offenders.
Wow. See, that's very upsetting to me. I mean, obviously, the kid should be punished. However, should they have to register as a sex offender for the rest of their life? That, to me, is a little bit harsh. So, Karen, what do you think about this sexting? I've never heard of this until tonight, but...
Sexting? Well, I'm absolutely outraged by the fact that 13-year-olds are doing this. I mean, where does it start? I mean, when I was 13, I didn't have a cell phone, you know? I mean, but I wasn't even anywhere near thinking about sex when I was 13 years old. I mean, do you deal with the parents, you know? Maybe they should take their cell phones away.
We have a caller on line 9 that I want to take. It's Jim from Islip has a question or comment in regard to the play cards that we were talking about. So I'm going to take his call right now. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening. I apologize because I'm up here on a visit, and I only caught part of the show and the comments. But I just wanted to make a comment about the placards. The individual mentioned something about comparing it to New York City, and I've been there for 23 years and now a sergeant.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly how, in official capacity, the placards are used here in Albany and Albany County. But down by us, and I don't know who was speaking, I think he did mention he worked with the Brooklyn DAs.
Yeah, that would have been Tom Carr. He was a former DA down in Brooklyn County.
Okay. I'm going back and I'm dating myself, but when I was a rookie, 86 and 87, I worked in the 79 precinct, and we got placards to try and park around the 79 precinct where we would respond. And there was even a parking lot out there. If you abused that placard, number one, you'd not only be brought up on departmental charges, but if you abuse it to the point where it did affect a vehicle and traffic law in New York State, you would most definitely be brought up on a charge for a summonsable offense, which then again would increase the department policing its own and going after you on an internal affairs issue.
Right.
Even when you parked your car in the lot, used your placard, the internal affairs officers or the inspections officers from that command or precinct would go through that parking lot. If you had, for example, expired inspection sticker on the windshield, they would bring you to task, even if it's on city property in their lot, they would bring you to task, mark your placard number, and bring it in and say, you're abusing your privilege to drive your car into New York City. So I think what Tom is, if it is, and I apologize, again, I'm calling in, I'm only hearing part of it, but when you're commenting about New York City police officers and the such, are there some individuals that may abuse it? I'm sure there are. But most, and I'm going to say a lot of us, would not even attempt it just to have that heat brought on you, both in the department, and if you're on a nice detail, you do not want to lose your detail if you're on a good assignment, nor do you want to pass that on to your family for, number one, the embarrassment, or bringing them in on some sort of charges. So I don't know, again, I'm kind of rambling, but I don't know what it is up here in Albany, what's going on. But down in New York City, absolutely not. You wouldn't have that.
Right, Jim, and that's what I was saying. I guess, as you said, you only caught part of it. Was what I was saying is they should bring in a system up here in Albany, like the system down there for the NYPD, because of the way it's run by the department down there.
Okay.
was not implying that NYPD officers are abusing their placards, not by any
means. Oh, okay, because I was going to find out, you know, where you parked your car. No, I'm only kidding.
Thanks,
Jim. I'm only kidding. But thank you for taking the time to listen, and I do apologize because I caught part of the show. But and I'm up here on a visit, and I do like the show. I will say that.
Great.
Guys are bringing out some really good points.
Have a good night.
Thank you very much. You too.
We have another caller on the line, on line 10. Bill from Saratoga County has some comments in regard to sex offenders. Bill, you're on the air.
Well, yeah. Actually, I heard in the news there was a case where there was a registered sex offender. However, he was guilty of having intercourse with a 16-year-old girlfriend, and they burned the house down where he was staying. Because on the Internet, it doesn't say what the offense was. It just says he's a sex offender.
Right.
And it differentiates whether he was underage at the time or maybe 1 year younger. He could even be younger than older or younger than the girl. I mean,
how old was the male in this case? The female was
16. He was like 17, and the girlfriend was 16.
Right. Yeah. I mean, these are tough questions. I mean, when they start processing,
they burned the house down, the vigilantes.
Right. Exactly. And
because they didn't have information on it, they just said yes or no. He's a sex offender. Kill him. You know, and burn his house, you know.
A good point about the registration, and we're going to talk about some of those issues, but thanks for the call, Bill.
Well, about the placards,
sure.
I think the only police disregard is employee discount.
An employee discount?
You know, I'm sure that's what they regard it as.
Good points.
You know, benefit, fringe benefit.
Yeah. Good points, Bill. Thanks. So getting back to the sex offenders that we were talking about, and Bill brought up an excellent point, is when people have to register, and registering is not just a picture, right, Tom? The registration actually has what, their address, the county? I mean,
right. There's level 1, 2, and 3 sex offenders, and level 2 and level 3s are the more serious ones, and their picture is posted on the website, their address, where they live, their date of birth. The police agency where they live can actually hand out flyers saying, you know, this guy, this is who he is, this is where he lives, he's in your neighborhood.
Yeah, and see, that's where I think it starts to get out of control is when we're handing out flyers. I mean, this sex offender or this person has basically they've served their jail time, they've paid their price back to society. How are they supposed to get back into society if, as soon as they're done with their jail time, we're handing out flyers, we're telling everyone where they live? I mean, to me, that kind of smells pretty bad. What do you think, Karen, about that?
I think you make a good point about, you know, we should probably give them a chance after they've paid their price in jail. It's, you know, you come out of jail and you see these things all around. It's like knocking you back down.
And we don't do the same thing with arsonists. I mean, you could have an arsonist who's living next door to you, and there's been studies, I think, that have shown that arsonists have a greater re-offense rate than basically sex offenders. So to me, I think this is a tough subject. We'd love to know what you think about this subject. Give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. Time for the news and weather. When we're back, we'll take a look at the domestic violence charges a popular young singer may soon be facing.
Fox News Radio, I'm Don Matheson. Matt Kenseth wins the Daytona 500.
Oh, my goodness. It's going to be really wet out here. It's probably going to cry like a baby, but just really need to thank my team and thank the Lord for giving me this opportunity.
Kenseth spoke to Fox Sports. NASCAR officials cut the race short because of rain. The commuter flight that crashed, killing 50 people near Buffalo, was on autopilot, and NTSB spokesman Steve Cheerlander says that's against the rules only if there's severe icing.
We don't know that it was severe icing. They didn't say severe icing. The weatherman didn't say it was severe icing.
Senator Roland Burris says Rod Blagojevich's brother asked him to contribute to the then-governor's campaign.
I made it very clear to him that I would not contribute, that it would be inappropriate and a major conflict because I'd expressed an interest in the Senate seat.
Republican state representatives are calling on Burris to resign. Fox News, we report, you decide.
810 WGY Storm Team Forecast.
A very typical mid-February forecast. The Arctic air stays in Canada, so temperatures are in the 30s for highs. Overnight lows will dip off into the teens and around 20 degrees. And we continue to settle down through the 20s here as we head through the rest of the night under a mostly clear sky, around 17 by daybreak. Monday, mostly sunny, around 32. Partly cloudy 32 Tuesday, rain and snow Wednesday. I'm Michael Palmer with the A10 WGY Storm Team Forecast.
Pets aren't just animals. They're companions and often members of the family. Unfortunately, pets are not always treated with the care they deserve. Animal cruelty and neglect are sadly a reality. Detecting and reporting abuse are the most important steps in bringing animal cruelty to an end. The Schenectady County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, SPCA, is a nonprofit volunteer organization that investigates complaints of animal cruelty. Our volunteers donate their time and energy because they believe in our mission to protect animals. We are not funded. We rely exclusively on public donations. You can help with a tax-deductible donation by calling 518-755-9517 or visit our website, SchenectadySPCA.org. Or if you'd like to join the Schenectady SPCA as a volunteer, again the number 518-755-9517 or on the web, SchenectadySPCA.org.
Are you contemplating a separation or divorce? Are you contesting the custody of your children? You have the right to receive effective legal advice that restores your peace of mind. The experienced attorneys at Tully Rinke can guide, counsel, and help you understand your choices. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.
Thanks for coming back to us. If you're a first-time listener, you're listening to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Rinke, and each Sunday at 7 p.m., I'm joined by the attorneys from my law firm, Tully Rinke PLLC, to give insight into the legal issues that matter most to you. We're broadcasting around the planet on WGY.com. Tonight, we're taking a look at some of the past month's most talked about political and legal issues. Joining me for the discussion are Tully Rinke criminal defense attorney Tom Carr and our guest Karen. So before the break, we were talking about sex offenders, and I want to go back to the point that you were making, Tom, about the restrictions of where sex offenders can live. And what are the restrictions of where – I know they can't live around schools, and there are other restrictions where they can't live. And I know Colony is trying to say that they can't live together, but where else can't sex offenders live?
Well, right now there's kind of a patchwork of laws around the state and around the country. For instance, Albany County has a residency law that says the level 3 sex offenders can't live within 1,000 feet of a school or a daycare center. The Colony proposal would obviously go further than that, but you know, I have to point out that Colony Board are really taking a step back. They're conducting a study to see, can they go forward with this bill, and you know, would this bill actually be effective? Now, other areas have come up with similar restrictions. There was one down in Rockland County that just recently a New York State Supreme Court judge said was illegal because it was too restrictive. And if you remember, during the special election in Schenectady, Ed Kosher was running against George Amador, and George Amador ultimately won that seat. And part of his strategy was to tie Ed Kosher to the sex offender restriction laws that were in place in Schenectady at that time. And those laws were so restrictive within the city of Schenectady that essentially it would mean the sex offenders would have to be placed out in the suburbs and out in the country.
Well, and that appears to me as to what's going to happen with this Colony proposal is a lot of these people that are being housed in these hotels, I would imagine, are people that have just been released from prison, probably have not been able to get back on their feet, and have no money. So basically, they're on welfare, and they're being put up by the county into these hotels. But where are these people going to go if they're not able to be housed in these hotels on the Strip? I don't know where they're going to go other than into the rural parts of the county, into the suburbs of the county. And to me, that just doesn't sound, reasonable. I mean, if the county's putting them up and they're putting them up in these hotels, I don't really see what the big issue is or the big concern is if they reside together. Has there been a study that shows that when you group sex offenders that they somehow they sex offend again?
Well, I think that this has been looked at on the town level, on the county level, on the state level, on the federal level, and no one's really come up with an answer. I mean, when I worked down at the state capitol, there was one proposal that one of the minimum security state prisons should be turned into essentially a dormitory for sex offenders so that they could, you know, keep them in there at night, let them out in the morning. Now,
and to me, that's just completely outrageous. I mean, these are people that have done their jail time to put them back into a prison type of environment. How are they ever going to be rehabilitated back into society? And that's one of the goals I always thought of the correctional system was to rehabilitate. Not to have people – they're punished clearly by the jail time. And when they come out, they can't keep having this stigma of, well, I got to go lock myself back in my cell tonight.
Right. You know? Well, that proposal didn't go anywhere. But, you know, the question is from which angle do you look at it? The politicians aren't going to be up there saying, you know, we want to advocate for the sex offenders. They're getting out of jail. They deserve a chance. No. The politicians are going to get their votes from – the general public, and they're going to push the issue. We're tough on crime. We're against sex offenders. Look what we're doing to keep you safe. And unfortunately, that's what's driving a lot of these restrictive laws.
Now, level one, that's the lowest level?
Level one is the one that is the least likely to reoffend. Level three is the level that's most likely to reoffend.
Now, do level one offenders have to register online? I mean, is there information all on there?
No, level one has the least amount of information. Level three has the most. So it's the level three ones that you're going to see with their picture, with their address, with their date of birth, where they live. And it's the level threes that the flyers can be handed out by the police department or someone can put them up. You know, you've seen them sometimes on telephone poles or trees in the neighborhood. There's a sex offender in your neighborhood. That's a level three.
How do you determine which ones are going to reoffend?
Well, before they're released from prison, they do a sex offender evaluation, and there's a scoring sheet depending on, you know, their level of familiarity with the victim, how many times they offended, whether or not force was used, and there's a scoring sheet. And then depending on the number that it comes up with at the end, that means you're a presumptive level one, level two, or level three. Then before they're released from prison, it has to go back to the sentencing judge. And there's actually a hearing held in court to see, is the presumption correct? Should there be an upward deviation? In other words, should someone that scores as a level two, is there some reason they should actually be a level three? Or there can be a downward deviation. Someone that, you know, may have been a level two, you know, there was one case where a guy, he was a level two sex offender, but he was paralyzed in prison. He had to get around by a wheelchair, which obviously made him much less likely to reoffend. There was a downward deviation in that case to a level one.
Okay.
Definitely an interesting issue, and, you know, there's good points on both sides. And I guess we'll just have to see how this pans out in Colony. I want to move on now to a topic that I profess I don't know too much about, but it's this Chris Brown and Rihanna. And first off, Chris Brown and Rihanna apparently involved in some sort of domestic violence. It's been all over the news. I don't believe charges have been filed at this point. But first off, Karen, who is Chris Brown and who is Rihanna? And what's going on here?
They are both actually in the R&B world. They're up and coming. Actually, they're pretty much up at this point. You know, I don't pay too much attention to the celebrity gossip, but they had a very, very big appeal, you know, to even myself, you know, very entertaining. And even the two of them together as a couple, you know, they were cute.
So they've been a couple.
Yes, they were out as a couple.
And how long have they been together for?
I think 6 months. You know, I can't tell you exactly.
Yeah, it's been about a year. There was a whole were they, weren't they for a long time, which they really milked for the publicity. But Apparently they've been together for about a year now.
Okay, so now apparently something happened on Grammy weekend. They were supposed to perform at the Grammys, I believe, right? Both of them were just
– Yes.
Did they perform together or separate or what's the deal here?
No, they have performed together.
Okay. So they were supposed to perform at the Grammys, but something happened. Some sort of domestic violence happened. And they ended up not performing at the Grammys.
Right.
What is alleged to have happened, Tom? Do you know?
Yeah, basically they were apparently on their way from a pre-Grammy party to the Grammys, and there was an altercation that apparently ensued in the car. Reports have come out since that apparently this was going on for a couple of days. It was going on for a weekend. But the police apparently found Rihanna with bruises and bite marks. And ultimately, they brought Chris Brown in, and he was charged, and he's been released on, I think, $50,000 bail.
Now, I had heard that the reason that they had gotten into this altercation, and I don't know if this is – of course, this is all gossip, but I had heard that he saw that Rihanna had gotten a text from someone at during this pre-party thing, and he was kind of pissed off that he was that she was talking to another guy. Is that what you had heard?
Well, you know, for whatever the reason, really there's no basis to respond with violence, although I guess at this point she no longer wants Chris Brown under her umbrella. you know, it's just indicative of the fact that domestic violence is something that crosses all cultural and socioeconomic lines, and it's something that can happen anywhere.
Now, had there been rumors, Karen, about Chris Brown and Rihanna having domestic violence issues in the past, or is this something new, or...?
The only thing that I had heard previously, and it was only a few days before it came out in the news that it actually was Rihanna, was just that Chris Brown was allegedly making criminal threats against a female. And then a few days later, after everyone saying, oh gosh, I hope it's not Rihanna, it turned out to be her. But before that, myself, I hadn't heard anything.
Now, I also saw in this morning's Times Union that it appears that Chris Brown's father came out and said that his son is very remorseful for what happened and feels terrible. Now, from a defense perspective, Tom, I would think that if I was a defense attorney, that I would be advising everyone to keep their mouth shut.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, you know, you can't control sometimes even your client, let alone the people on the periphery of your client. One thing that apparently has come out since then is that Chris Brown was a witness to domestic violence as a child growing up, in that his mother was abused by her significant other, her boyfriend at the time.
And I think that's a very important little nugget of information, because in my experience of having worked with domestic violence clients, history has a tendency to repeat itself. I mean, people that have grown up around domestic violence, unfortunately, I think have a tendency to sometimes regress back to domestic violence. So I think that's definitely interesting that I didn't know that he had grown up and had witnessed domestic violence of his own mother.
Yeah, and the irony is he has been outspoken in the past against domestic violence, and yet here we are in the situation that he's currently in with Rihanna.
Now, he has hired an attorney, correct?
Yeah, I believe he's hired Mark Garagos, the attorney for Scott Peterson.
Ah, so I knew we knew that name from somewhere, so Scott Peterson. Interesting. So now, I've also heard that calls to domestic violence hotlines are increasing in the past year. Why do you think that is? I mean, is it because of the economy? I mean, what's going on here? Why would domestic violence be increasing because of the economy?
Well, partly it is because of the economy. I mean, let's face it, a number one reason for divorce in this country is money issues between the partners. And as the economy goes south, a lot of people are losing their jobs. There's a lot more restrictions on money in the households, which can lead to more conflict and therefore more domestic violence. So I think there's a direct correlation between the direction the economy has been heading in and the amount of domestic violence that's out there.
Now, in this case, in the Rihanna case, did Rihanna call the police after this happened? Do we know? Or did that – because I'm not sure that – I know that the police were called to the scene, but I think it was from a bystander, because I believe that what happened was is the incident took place, started off in this Lamborghini, right? Didn't they rent a Lamborghini for $1,000 a day or something?
Yeah, Chris Brown had rented a Lamborghini. I think it was for $2,000.
$2,000. Yeah. Wow, that's a lot of money. So they drove off after this party, and I believe they pulled off into a suburban housing area, and the fight continued. But then I think they got out of the car at one point, and the fight continued out of the car. And it's my understanding that one of the neighbors overheard this ruckus and called the police, and it wasn't Rihanna who called the police. Is that common in domestic violence incidents where you don't have the victim calling, you have sometimes witnesses or family members calling?
Yeah, it's very common. Frequently, the victim doesn't want to go forward, doesn't want to press charges, even after the police are called.
Now, what happens in this case, if the police are called, they clearly saw – now, I know the reports, and of course, we don't know the facts exactly, but the reports say that she was bloody, there was some bite marks and bruising. Now, what happens if she says, well, me and Chris Brown have made up, and I don't want to press charges? Are the police bound to press charges?
Well, charges are pressed by the district attorney's office, not by the victim. And having worked in the Domestic Violence Bureau down in the Brooklyn DA's office, and having worked in the Sex Crime Special Victims Bureau in Rensselaer County, you know, frequently as a prosecutor, you know, they have gone forward in the past, even where the victim will come forward and at trial testify on behalf of the defendant. And
well, I know that happened.
Gotten, right?
That happened all the time when I was prosecuting domestic violence cases. Is you'd have the case all ready to go, and all of a sudden your star victim would come in and say that she made up, and no, she maybe didn't remember the story right, and it was very discouraging because you knew that potentially she was going back right back into the situation she came from.
Right, and ultimately, you know, you can't save people from themselves sometimes. But a lot of cases with domestic violence, you know, the victims, which predominantly is the woman, they're afraid to leave, whether it's for economic reasons, whether they're afraid that they'll lose custody of their children or whatever.
So, Karen, do you think is Chris Brown's career done, or is he going to recover from this?
I guess we never can tell because, after all, he is a celebrity. And in the past, you see that a lot of times the celebrities, they come out of it. I mean, he is only, 19 years old, 20 years old? So he has a lot of years ahead of him. You know, I mean, he could make up for what he's done. I don't think it would be right. You know, I mean, I personally watched a friend go through something similar, and they weren't married. They didn't have kids. And, you know, I mean, he had a hold over her for over 2 years. And
wow. Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens with Chris Brown and Rihanna. So we'll be covering this definitely on future shows. Time for a short break. When we're back, we'll explain just what the indictment of former Senator Joe Bruno was about and what he's alleged to have done. Feel free to give us a call with any of your questions. To reach us, call 1-800-TALK-WGY or press *WGY on your cell phone. If you don't have a chance to get in touch with us tonight, you can always reach us at the Tully Rinke office all week at 518-218-7100.
Have you taken stock of your assets and long-term financial goals? Are there changes in your family or finances? The experienced attorneys at Tully Rinke PLLC can provide estate planning services, including wills, trusts, tax planning, powers of attorney, probate, and long-term care planning. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY.
Usually, a mortgage company's sole focus is property, but first-rate funding is centered on people, not property. Whether you're buying a home or struggling with your current adjustable-rate mortgage, first-rate funding will give you the same amazing personal service. First-rate funding, New Carner Road, Albany, and Broadway, Saratoga Springs. Don't wait. Call today, 452-4700, and please go online, firstratefunding.net, and see how they can help you today. Registered mortgage broker, New York State Banking Department. Mortgage loans arranged with third-party providers.
As a busy working professional, looking good's important to you. No one understands this better than Best Cleaners, the Capital Region's premier garment care provider and dry cleaner. Got a wrinkle in your schedule? Best Cleaners offers pickup and delivery of your dry cleaning right from your home or office, so you don't have to fit one more errand into your busy week. Call 458-BEST, and we'll take care of the rest. With three locations in Del Mar, Loudonville, and on the Latham Circle, Best Cleaners. Always look your best. Call 458-BEST. 458-BEST.
You know this isn't the right job for you, but the problem is you don't know what the right job is. If you're looking for career advice, Careers in Transition LLC can help. Careers in Transition LLC is a career counseling firm that helps you figure out the right job for you. They're not an employment agency, and Dr. Tom Denham is not a headhunter, but they can help you write a better resume, prep for a job interview, and a lot more. Careers in Transition LLC, 11 Computer Drive West in Albany, 366-8451, and online, Careers in Transition LLC.com.
We're back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Greg Rinke, and tonight I'm joined by criminal defense attorney Tom Carr. Also with us is Karen. Find out more about the show at WGY.com or visit TullyLegal.com to see what else we can do for your legal needs. So we're going to shift gears here a little bit and talk about former Senator Joe Bruno. And I know in last week's newspaper, I remember reading the paper and seeing something that's been called or affectionately nicknamed the Bruno-mobile. And I guess the Bruno-mobile had to deal with a van that was purchased by Senator Bruno and it was basically to ferry him around the state on official business. And I guess this van, what did it cost, $50,000 or so?
Yeah, it was a $50,000 GMC custom conversion van.
Custom conversion van, and in the back seat it had, what, four leather chairs and
a conference table.
Conference table, and I know it had a rear view backup camera, and now I guess this this vehicle, this van, this custom van has been sitting where, under the Capitol garage?
Yeah, it's down on level P3 of the Empire State Plaza right now. It's been parked there gathering dust since the Republicans lost the majority in the Senate.
And it's got, what, 12,000 miles, I think, on it, and no one wants to be seen in it, I guess. So what's your thinking on this, Karen? I mean, the taxpayers paid for this, right, Tom?
Right, absolutely.
$50,000 or so, and now they're lucky if they're going to sell it, because nobody wants to be seen in this thing. And they're going to sell it for, I think, like $12,000 or something. So what's your thinking on this as a taxpayer, Karen?
Well, I had no idea about the Bruno Mobile until, you know, maybe a week or so ago. So that's absolutely insane. I helped pay for that.
Now, I guess the argument to this is maybe we saved money because he wasn't flying around, because that was the whole argument when Senator Bruno was in the argument with former Governor Spitzer was he flying on when he should not be flying in state aircraft? Wasn't that the argument?
Right. The whole issue back then was he using state aircraft for personal uses? Now, they've done their investigations, and he's never faced any charges for that. But at the time, the governor put a restriction on Senator Bruno's use of state aircraft. So in order to get him around to official state functions, the Senate majority purchased this van. It's all-wheel drive, and I think it gets 8 miles to the gallon.
So, but maybe we actually saved money because he wasn't using the aircraft.
Well, even at 8 miles a gallon, I'm sure it was more cost-effective than flying around on a jet. But at the same time, it's still $50,000 plus, and it has certainly depreciated a lot down to the point of $12,000 now that they reckon is what they'll get for it.
So I guess if anyone out there listening is interested, I guess this is going to be up for sale for, what, like $12,000, so you might be able to get a good deal on a van.
I believe the Blue Book is about $16,000 on it, but their figure, because of the way the economy is and the poor mileage it gets, that they'll probably get around $12,000 for it.
Hmm, interesting. So now, the former Senator Bruno, he's been indicted, correct?
Yeah, he's been federally indicted, and just this past week they came out with a tentative trial date of November 2nd of this year.
Now, that seems awfully quick to me. I mean, I was expecting this trial to drag out. I mean, is November quick? I guess federal trials move quicker than state trials, right?
Right. In fact, it's a little slower than I think the U.S. attorney wanted. They indicated that they would be ready to go to trial in May, but the federal judge said, you know, given the notoriety of the case, the difficulty they're going to have in terms of jury pool, and also with all the motions that Senator Bruno's attorneys wish to file, that they'll be lucky if they get it going in November.
Now, what exactly has Bruno been indicted of? What is it? Honest services? Is that what they've got him on?
Yeah, they got him under a very vague. It's called the Honest Services Provision of the Federal Mail Fraud Act. And it's a very, very vague and loosely defined, in fact, it's really not defined anywhere, provision of the law.
What exactly does it have to do? What exactly do they believe he did wrong? I mean, that's where I'm having the trouble, and I think the average layperson out there is having trouble getting around, is what are they saying that he did that was illegal?
Basically, what they're saying is he deprived the electorate of
Meaning us.
Of his honest services as a politician, now, which seems very, very vague. It was an 8-count indictment, and one of the things that formed the basis of one of the charges in the indictment was that he would, say, make a recommendation allegedly to a union who was looking for an investment advisor. And if that union then hired that investment advisor, then that investment advisor or the parent company would give sort of a referral fee to a company that Joe Bruno worked for or a consulting company that Joe Bruno was affiliated with.
But is there anything illegal in that sense if there's no pressure or there's no you know, I mean, is it a kickback, really?
Well, no, it's specifically not a kickback, and it's not a bribe, because if it were, then they would have charged him with accepting illegal gratuity or with bribery. But they didn't charge him under either of those two theories, this despite a three-year investigation.
So basically, any politician that's out there, I think, has to be watching this and has to be very leery of their dealings or recommendations to other industries.
Absolutely. I mean, this honest services provision is so vague, and it's not limited to politicians. It's not limited to public servants. This would apply to the private sector as well. So theoretically, and I know this is it's not going to happen. It's so unlikely. But, you know, if you're at work one day and you're goofing off on your computer, you're looking up, you know, something on the internet that's not related to your work, technically you're depriving your employer of your honest services as an employee. And you could be charged under this federal statute because it meets the broad, vague definition contained within that statute.
But isn't this going to be a problem for the federal United States Attorney to prove his case, because it seems like it's very vague?
They have to prove what's called a scheme to defraud. Now, it has been trotted out a lot against politicians and against public servants, but ultimately they have a very, very high conviction rate using this. Because
so this has been used before?
This has been used before. Randy Duke Cunningham, for instance, out in California, and with the Jack Abramoff issue down in D.C., the lobbyist, they got an Ohio congressman, Bob Ney, under this, under the honest services provision.
Now, are those cases under appeal, or have they reached a final determination?
Well, I think with the Bob Ney case, it wound up being a negotiated plea, because it's quite a hammer to have over your head. You know, you're facing 20 years on each one of these counts. So if they come up with a plea deal where the person admits guilt and comes up with a shorter sentence, then, you know, they can really force defendants into it.
What do you think is going to happen here? What's your prediction, Tom? I know you don't have the crystal ball, but we're going to see a plea?
I don't think we will. I think Joe Bruno's going to take this all the way.
Well, that's it for us this Sunday. If you didn't have a chance to reach us this evening, we can be found all week at the Tully Rinke offices at 518-218-7100. Thanks for listening. We'll be here on WGY each Sunday at 7 p.m. Be sure to join us next week when Barb King with a special guest from the Legal Aid Society.